The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
What comes to your mind when you think of the word church? Anybody? The body of believers. All right. The old children's thing was, here's the church and there's the steeple, open the doors and there are all the people, something like that. So you already jumped right to the people. That's what you had in mind by a body of believers. Okay, that's not the immediate thing that would come to a childlike mind. One would probably think of a building with certain normal furnishings that we would have in a church, possibly pews, possibly a pulpit, things like that. What other things leap to your mind when the word church is used? Say it again.
Christ, who is the head of the church.
All right. You all are so profound, you're going way beyond the easy, obvious answers. You have to realize church history is a course that starts out very simple and basic. So. Let me then give you some New Testament ideas that'll get at what I'm concerned. That's a good answer, by the way. In the New Testament, the word church has several meanings or references. It can mean, and most often does, a local congregation. And that's what I think most people would think of right away. And when you said a body of believers, you may have been thinking of gathered in one local place, although you might have been thinking of the church in a far vaster concept. All those believers, maybe even not just at present, but past, and possibly future as well. Well, in the New Testament, the word church most often does mean a local congregation. It's often expressed in the plural, churches. One example would be Acts chapter 15, verse 41, where it says, Paul went through Syria and Cilicia strengthening the churches. All right, there are obviously several local congregations are in view. It can mean what our two brothers who answered the question had in mind, the church universal. When Paul says in Ephesians 5:25, husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church. There, obviously, the word is being used for that whole body of believers, of which Christ is the head. 1 Corinthians 15:9, Paul says, I am the least of the apostles and do not even deserve to be called an apostle because I persecuted the church of God. And that meant when he was Saul of Tarsus that he was persecuting Christians wherever he found them. So it was the church universal and his zeal as a Pharisaical Jew. That's the way he's using the term there. Now, I think most of us are quite accustomed to using the word in those two senses, a local congregation or the church universal. It can also refer to the regional church. This is something that isn't always so obvious. Acts 5:11, it says, great fear seized the whole church. Now, by then, thousands had come to Christ right there in Jerusalem as a result of Pentecost and the Spirit's ongoing work, and there were clearly more than could even be gathered in one local congregation. But the word church is used in the singular to describe then what was by that time already the regional church. It would be several probably house churches that were connected in fellowship there in the early chapters of Acts. Acts 8, verse 1, on that day a great persecution broke out against the church at Jerusalem. Here again, after thousands had come to Christ, It speaks of the church in the singular, so it's referring to the regional church. Also, Acts 20, verse 17, from Miletus, Paul sent to Ephesus for the elders of the church. The word used in the singular, but he had been in Ephesus for about 3 years, and clearly he had planted more than just one congregation in that large, significant city. So these are elders. Apologize to those of you who may not be Presbyterian, but this was Paul's gathering with the Ephesian elders was a presbytery meeting. Was the regional church functioning. So the word church has these various levels of meaning. Now, let me press this on a little more. This is just to get you reflecting on the title of the course before we get into the actual substance of it. But when you think about the church now and its local manifestation, the local congregation, what aspects of it come to mind? What are the functions of the local church that are most characteristic or most significant? Anybody? Worship. All right. Worship, certainly a crucial, essential thing. If we didn't worship, it would just be a club, some other type of organization. So worship is obviously a key ingredient. What else? Fellowship. What do you mean when you say fellowship? Who said it? I heard a voice out there. I didn't see that hand. Anybody, what is meant by fellowship? Koinonia. Flesh it out a little bit, Daniel. Say it.
Coming together.
How do you do it in Nigeria?
One, local building, pastoral visitation.
All right, you gather for worship. It's not just an individual isolated from the rest of the company of believers. So the fellowship gets expressed even in the context of worship, but then beyond that, in meeting one another's needs, right? I suspect the reason I pressed you a little bit is I suspect the Nigerian church is way ahead of the American church in how it does some of these things. Some of our staff had the privilege of visiting in Nigeria this summer. Mrs. Donna Conley and Mrs. Patty Comer, Registrar and Associate Dean of Students, and brought back to the faculty some pictures as well as accounts of experience there. And Elizabeth Mathias and Sue Post of our student body also went and want to go back. So, fellowship may not always be emphasized enough in the American church with our high degree of individualism, but that's certainly a part of it. What else? Maybe elaborating a little more on what happens in worship?
Administrations.
Yes. All right, Tom, describe that a little more. The sacraments obviously are a function of the local church, the Lord's Supper, baptism. And as we look at the ancient church, we'll see as it moved towards the Middle Ages, developing beyond those two into other things that were regarded as sacraments too. But the sacraments are a means of grace, as our Westminster Confession and Catechisms describe them, along with the Word and prayer. So obviously the Word, the reading and the preaching of the Word would be an important function of the local church, and prayer. All right, that's the local manifestation. Now, thinking of the regional manifestation. I know not everybody here is Presbyterian, so this is an unfair question, but how many of you have ever been to a presbytery meeting? Okay. A few have functioned there as elders, and some got to their first one probably this last Saturday up in Scranton, where the Philadelphia Presbytery of the PCA met. What sorts of aspects of the church's life are manifest in the regional church, with which most of you aren't that familiar directly? Tom, you're one who's okay. In the Presbyterian system, and other denominations have their way of dealing with these things also, If a problem arises in the local church, it can't be resolved there, you can appeal to a broader body of the believers, elders, sometimes with greater experience, but with also the collective wisdom of the body that can help solve that. And it can be just like our judicial system in the secular, where there can be an appeal that goes on, and then the higher level deals with that. So matters of church government. In our Presbyterian system, I think myself, this is a personal opinion, probably the most important function the presbytery has is the examining of candidates for the ministry, leading to, well, there are three steps usually of coming under the care of the presbytery. How many of you here are under care of a presbytery? Okay, a good many of you have gone through that level of the activity, which involves giving your personal testimony of salvation and then expressing your sense of call to serve the Lord. And then in our case, we ask you, why this particular denomination? Not that that rules out everybody else, but we want to know, why are you affiliating with this particular body? And then following that, the next step is what we call licensure, where you're examined in theology. In the old days, it was supposed to happen after 2 years of seminary. Problem is, the curriculum doesn't usually cover some of the crucial areas of systematic theology that early. So tendency is for people to come and be licensed towards the end of their seminary training. And the purpose of that is to check out a person's doctrine. Coming under care gets into areas of character, but this is to check out your doctrine so that we can license you to preach on a regular basis in the pulpits of the denomination as there's opportunity. And then you manifest your gifts that way, and lo and behold, some group of God's people may want to call you to be pastor, or a missions agency may want to call you to be a missionary. And once a call like that comes, then your final examination with presbytery for the sake of ordination. And then there's an ordination service. Once you've completed that examination and answered to, or ready to take vows as to your crucial beliefs, there's a very solemn and joyful occasion when the elders lay hands on you and you are an ordained minister. So the presbytery has that sort of responsibility. And then all kinds of other things of government, also evangelism and church planting. The regional church can play an important role in that by encouraging local churches, maybe spreading certain gifts around. You may have somebody who's particularly effective in training people in personal evangelism, so you send him around to the different local churches to have that experience. And then the other local churches band together to plant a new church somewhere. And I'm glad to see in the PCA this is happening almost constantly now. One right in our midst, 10th Presbyterian Church, which the Lord has blessed with resources and a wonderful history, is now gaining a vision for planting new churches. And Adam Bryce, of our PhD program, is the pastor of the new church in Conshohocken. They also are going to plant a church in African American community in West Philly. Lance Lewis, product of 10th, who's been down in getting training in the Washington, D.C. area, now in Atlanta, is going to come back in another year and be the pastor for a new church plant there. Those aren't the only ones, but there are many, many such efforts. In the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, Chip Stonehouse, who died just this past summer, was the presbytery evangelist of the OP's Philadelphia Presbytery, and planted dozens of churches, not only here but earlier in Maine and New England, and was very effective in doing that. A great loss to us that he's gone home to the Lord as early as he has. But that's something else that the regional church does. It also can be a great testimony to the community. Dr. Peter Lilback, who does some teaching for us, who's pastor at Proclamation PCA Church in the Bryn Mawr area, has been very concerned to get resolutions passed in our presbytery, emphasizing the pro-life movement, reminding us of things we had previously said as a denomination, but needing to have a public testimony of these things again, as well as some opposition to certain of the gay community's emphases nowadays and so forth. So that's another thing. Also, mercy ministries. It's important that every local congregation have some mercy ministry, but you can encourage one another. A small church is not always able to do a whole lot in that area, but banding together several local churches and the regional church can have deacons that are meeting the needs of a variety of people. Again, out of 10th Presbyterian Church, Harvest, which was the outreach to the homosexual and lesbian community, spawned the ministry called Hope, which tries to bring God's mercy to people with the HIV virus and AIDS. And this has been very effective in just ministering to such people and presenting the gospel of Jesus Christ to people in their need. And one other facet I think comes to mind is youth work. And probably a lot of you have experienced this, that often when you have a camp for young people, you don't just get the young people from one congregation, which may again be limited in numbers, but you have a camp for the whole regional church. And it engenders fellowship among the young people by having youth work joined in that way. All right, that's a second level of the church's life then. The third one is a denominational manifestation. What things come to mind when you think of your own denomination, what it does in OPC or PCA circles is be called the General Assembly. Other denominations, Southern Baptists have their convention, for example. What particular concerns are there at that level of the church?
Doctrine.
Okay. Each denomination usually has some doctrinal standards. In Presbyterian circles, the Westminster Confession of Faith and the larger and shorter catechisms. Others have the Reformed tradition has the three forms of unity: Heidelberg Catechism, Belgic Confession, Canons of the Synod of Dort. Even Baptist churches, which tend not to emphasize an elaborate statement of doctrine, will have some kind of a formula. So that's something that tends to happen at that level. What else is done at that sort of denominational level, the highest jurisdiction of a denomination that's important? How about missions? It's true. A local church is qualified to send out a missionary. The regional church also can do that. But with all the complications there tend to be with overseas missions, of visas and finances and so forth, it's usually better done at the denominational level. And so you have a mission committee or board of a denomination that sends the gospel on to places that have not yet been reached. Evangelized. And similarly, education, publications, things like that tend to be done at that denominational level. When I say education, many denominations have a denominational seminary. Westminster happens to be independent. We're not governed by a particular church body, but there are other examples of ones that are denominational, where the Board of Trustees might be elected by the denomination and so forth. And so that's a type of concern. But beyond that, usually most denominations will have a Christian education committee that will furnish literature for Sunday school and things like that that are helpful at that level. Finally, a fourth level that, again, while we sometimes think of it theoretically, it isn't something we practically deal with. And yet I'm more and more impressed with the importance of it. And that's in its universal manifestation. What really are the functions of the church in terms of its universal manifestation? When you said the body of believers originally, you weren't thinking just of a local congregation, but really of all Christians. In this room, we no doubt represent many, many different denominations. Westminster has students every year from often, it's amazing to me, often almost as many denominations as we have students. I think out of 600 and some students, we usually have about 200 denominations represented in a year's statistics, which is quite amazing. But we already then experience some of the fellowship that crosses all kinds of denominational lines here. But when we think of that universal church where you can meet somebody on an airplane sitting next to you and find out that she or he is a believer, and immediately you feel that sense of brotherhood or sisterhood. But what are the functions of the church at that level? Are there any practical functions? Yes, sir. Yes, all right, which we all strive to do individually, but then we can cooperate. We find ways, and the way our American denominational system is, this often is realized more in parachurch organizations, where we can join with people of like Precious Faith, but maybe of a different denomination, in being salt and light. I've been privileged to be my denomination's representative for several years, not in the last few years, to the National Association of Evangelicals. And that has everything from Assembly of God to Christian Reformed Church. Missouri Synod Lutherans have come as observers. So it's quite a widespread group of people that all will profess about a 12-point statement of faith, which is very simple. But it stresses the authority of the Bible and the essentials of the gospel. And that group can be salt and light in some significant ways. They have an office in Washington, D.C. that cultivates relationships with legislators in the Senate and the House of Representatives, sometimes with the White House, and can do effective, use a bad word, lobbying for the sake of the church and the gospel. I'll mention one example that brings it right home. Bob Fu took this course earlier, but Bob Fu is in our student body, was helped out of China. He had managed to get from mainland China to Hong Kong, but our State Department was helping refugees from Hong Kong as it was reverting to Chinese control, only if they were political refugees. And the NAE spoke to the State Department and said, here are some religious refugees who will indeed be persecuted if they are not pulled out of Hong Kong. And so Bob and Heidi Fu, by virtue of the NAE, were enabled to come to America and enroll at Westminster Seminary. So there's an example of how that can work. And that just brings to light where persecution is often one of the functions, if we think of it negatively, of the church in the universal sense. You should feel, we all should feel, our spiritual kinship with Christians in southern Sudan. Our media don't play up as much as they ought to what is going on there. But and I certainly don't know all the details. There no doubt are political and sources of oil issues involved and so on. But Christians there are being horribly persecuted by the Muslim powers that exist there. And we should feel these are our brothers and sisters who are being mistreated in this way. And likewise, in many, many parts of the world, we should be conscious of the church at that universal level. Not just in terms of persecution, but of missions, theology. We should try to find what we have in common, even though we may have distinctives in our own personal beliefs or our own denominational circles that won't always find agreement. But we have to be conscious. Philippians 1:10 is a good verse to remember. I heard Professor John Frame speak on this many years ago. Paul's prayer there, it'd be good to get the words right. This is my prayer, he says, starting in verse 9, that your love may abound more and more in knowledge and depth of insight so that you may be able to discern what is best. and may be pure and blameless until the day of Christ, filled with the fruit of righteousness that comes through Jesus Christ to the glory and praise of God. To be able to discern what is best. And as Professor Frame of Westminster in California developed this many years ago when I heard him do it, it had to do with discerning the degrees of priority, degrees of importance among the things that we all would profess, and being able to find common ground on the things that are the heart of the gospel, where salvation is at stake, and agree to be able to differ on secondary issues. That's a matter of Christian maturity, to be able to discern the difference between what is primary and what is secondary, which Paul prayed that the Philippians might gain. So out of that then is a sense of the unity of the church across all the different cultural and denominational personal differences that may exist. Now, I mention all of this just to have us, as we start thinking about the history of the church, to have an idea of how many different levels that word operates, biblically and theologically and in experience. So that when we talk about the ancient church, you think of it in all those dimensions. That's the challenge I want to put before you. Well, let me talk about the word ancient for just a moment. The way we use this word is when we speak, at least in Western civilization, of ancient civilization, that means the Greco-Roman world, starting usually with what we call the classical period. The height of it might be 5th century BC in Athens, time of Socrates and Plato, and as you go into the 4th century, Aristotle in terms of philosophy, the great playwrights, Aeschylus, Sophocles, Euripides, and so on. And that marvelous civilization, marvelous from a secular standpoint, because it was still spiritually lost, but that did develop in ancient Greece. And it's the Greek language, of course, through which the New Testament truth has been conveyed to us. So the Lord used that as an instrument. We'll talk more about that in a moment. But it's the Greco-Roman period. The Romans, starting in about the 3rd or 2nd century BC, began to spread their power over the Mediterranean world, absorb that Greek culture. They recognized the value of it. And it's often been said, although the Romans conquered Greece and much of the old empire of Alexander the Great that had spread all the way, they didn't go as far as he did to the east, to the Indus Valley in India, but into Persia, or at least conflicting with Persia. The Roman world, although conquering the ancient Greek world, was conquered by it culturally. And so it's best described as Greco-Roman civilization in the classical period, and the church comes into that context of the Mediterranean world. And so it's that classical period. Usually it's regarded as going down to, there's sometimes various arbitrary dates given for the fall of the Roman Empire in the West, but we could say into the 5th century, into the 400s AD. So you have about a millennium there of, called the classical period, and in the middle of it, the birth of Christ takes place. And our study will be from approximately AD 100 to 600, 5 centuries worth. We'll leave the 1st century to the New Testament department, so you learn about the work of the apostles and their immediate successors there. We pick it up around 100. Actually, we'll have you reading in the first assignment, Clement of Rome. It's our first post-apostolic writing, writing in around the 90s. And we'll pick it up from there. The Didache, some would even say, is earlier than that, but that's debatable. And then we carry it down to about 600, so we actually are moving into what is usually considered the medieval, early medieval period of Western history. So that's just to define the terms a little bit of ancient church history. Now this sheet has gotten around to everybody, I'm sure, by this time. And by the way, let me say, if somebody in the back before the end of class will be sure to bring up any extras. Were there enough for everybody to get around to everybody? Nobody's without this Everybody in the back got one? Okay, well, if somebody in the back will be sure each time to bring any extras up of handouts and also that attendance sheet, I'll appreciate that. I'd like to go over these matters now, and please don't hesitate to interrupt, not only today but in the future if there are questions that arise and want to explain this. Let's look first at the back of the first page, the description of the course. And these things are mostly clear enough, speak for themselves, but I just want to go over them quickly. Four objectives of the course. Number one, a knowledge of the main events and people in the course of the church's history from apostolic times through AD 600. So there are a certain number of facts that I do want you to master. As you do the reading, you'll feel it's like a blizzard, like looking through your windshield when you're driving through a storm, you know, and it'll be very hard to absorb all of that. Take heart, as I go through with the lectures, there will be several tracks, as I'll mention in a moment, you'll begin to hear certain things repeated, and I hope that will reinforce certain things and help you to find the textbook is not just like reading the phone book, but certain themes will begin to stand out. There are certain key dates, and we'll be emphasizing those by way of the lecture as well as in the reading. But try and absorb as much as you can. If questions occur to you, I jot them down. We'll have time for discussion of those in class from time to time, I hope once a week. But that's important. You can't get to the fun stuff, that is interpretation and making judgments about history, until you have a grasp of some of the factual knowledge. And do pay attention to dates, because in the study of history, it's important. We're really trying to look at causation. What is it that brought something to pass? And if you don't have things in proper chronological order, you certainly won't understand the sequence and why something may have taken place. Second, then, is a grasp of the development of Christian thought and of the formulation of the church's doctrine. The textbook that I referred to is Henry Chadwick, The Early Church. I haven't checked with the bookstore. I trust there are enough copies. Has anybody had any frustration getting books? We run short? We have. Okay, they'll be in touch with me and we'll make sure enough are ordered. They are on reserve in the library. All the required texts are available there. So those who don't have one from the bookstore, you can make use of it there and try to share it with others who may be in the same boat. Henry Chadwick is Anglican, won't always agree with him, read him critically. Tends to be more in the liberal direction than we at Westminster would be. But it's compact, valuable description of the early church. He is an authority, and it's inexpensive, being in paperback. That was one of the considerations. But for the history of doctrine, there'll be plenty of doctrine referred to in Chadwick, but Jaroslav Pelikan's Christian Tradition, Volume 1, covers exactly our period, and 100 to 600, and is really a profound work. I use Volume 4 in the Reformation course, and so you can see he develops this all the way through the church's history. And Pelikan was Lutheran. Recently, a year or so ago, joined the Eastern Orthodox Church, which didn't surprise me when that happened. You'll find, first of all, he has a great knowledge of the Eastern Church as well as the Western tradition. And if you look at his annotated bibliography in the back, very valuable comments on a lot of sources. And also one of the unique things about his book, you don't have footnotes, you don't have end notes, but you have side notes. And I think it's a great system. When he quotes from a particular source, he has the reference right out to the side in the side margin. And he does give, I think in this volume, it's in the front, explanation of all the abbreviations he uses. And so make use of that. I think this will be the most difficult reading that you'll find in this course. Some students, I find, just love Pelican. That's their favorite in this course. They're usually in the minority. Most students find this is a bit more of a struggle, and I urge you, Pelican does write in a fashion that lends itself to browsing through it first. Usually has a page or two of introduction to a chapter, and he'll give you his outline. Then just thumb through and see what his subtitles are, and you'll know where he's going. And then he'll usually have something of a summary at the end of the chapter. So do that first, and it'll give you an idea of where it's all heading, and then plow through it, and then review it again when you're through. And by three quick travels through the chapter, you'll probably get a good handle on it. So that is another important part of what we'll do, the history of Christian thought in the formulation of the church's doctrine. Then third, an understanding of leading figures in the life of the church, intimate enough with certain ones, the student can form a degree of identification with such figures. I've been helped through my now long history of serving the Lord by having certain heroes. Jonathan Edwards, I did research on him early on. I wish I could say I had kept it up because there was a very valuable figure, but he's continued to be an important model. John Calvin, obviously, is one of the outstanding figures of the past for many of us. Dr. Machen, who helped to found this seminary. There are several people that just become models for you in your ministry, and it's interesting that back in the ancient church, we know enough about certain ones to have them function that way. I'll have some positive things to say about Athanasius. John Chrysostom would be one of the people you have an option of reading, but above all, Augustine. And we know not only Augustine's thought, but also a good bit of his life, thanks to his own autobiographical confessions. So that's an important part. I do believe in a biographical approach to history. It's much like the history that's in the Bible, after all, where we learn a lot about Moses and David and Peter and so forth. So there's a lot to be gained that teaches us many lessons for how we can live. And insofar as they reflect Christ, we can follow their example, or in their sins and failings, we can learn from those as well. So that's another part of what we'll be looking at. Number four is probably the most controversial, a sense of God's providence as it is seen working in the overall pattern of the church's history. Professional historians kind of rule this out in the secular world, and even in Christian circles, there's a lot of debate as to how far we can really go in this direction. Some good, solid, scholarly Christian historians will say, well, you might have it in the Bible, but we're not qualified to detect the hand of God. Is the earthquake in Turkey a judgment from God? God's in control, but we can't draw that conclusion. Like the man born blind in John chapter 9, apostles asked Jesus, who was the sinner, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? And Jesus says, it's not that, it's for the sake of the glory of God to be revealed. So we don't always know, and we need to be humble about that and not claim. What was the defeat of the Spanish Armada in 1588? God's providence? I believe it was, quite frankly. The Reformation was about to be crushed. Philip II of Spain had this huge fleet. England was one of the few places protecting the gospel. But the comeback is, you have to say, that even though the Armada was defeated, that then Elizabeth could start persecuting the Puritans, now that she didn't have to worry about the Catholics. So there are a lot of tricky calls in seeing the providence of God in history, and we ought to acknowledge that. But I want to encourage you to look for the hand of God in history. We do have it in the Bible, where we have God's infallible revelation of what was happening when the Babylonian captivity took place. It was a judgment. Jeremiah tells us that in Kings and Chronicles, likewise. And we We have explanations of that. Well, if that was true back then, it's true. But he also is dealing with the nations as a whole. And so we ought to try to detect the hand of God as we go through the history of the church in this period and understand it. Maybe that'll generate some discussion as we go through this fall's study. Well, those are objectives then. As to methods, real quickly, there are four tracks that we have for absorbing material in this course. Wonderful, we had a time machine, we could all go back and just live it again or view it that way. I'm not sure whether we'll get that chance in heaven, but it would be fun, at least for me as a historian, to find out the real truth about these things as God saw it. But lacking that, we have narrative texts such as Chadwick. Rely on that to fill in the gaps that may be left from all the other sources. And if you're uncertain about something, this is a good reference to go check out the facts. And then we have the history of doctrine in Pelican. Now, that'll be another track. And as you read, I've tried to get the assignments so that we get them at the proper time, but they won't always coincide chronologically. And then there will be source materials. I'll be using this book, Staniforth and Louth, Early Christian Writings, and your first assignment for next Tuesday will include Clement of Rome out of this book. And so we'll be focusing primarily on the early fathers in the basically in the second century from this book, a little bit in the late first century. Because I feel it's very important that all of you get exposure to the writings immediately after the apostolic writings. You can sense the difference, but also the degree of continuity there is. The church already begins to deviate from the word pretty fast, as we'll see. And then you'll have an inexpensive paperback book with selections from Tertullian. Again, one of the more bombastic figures of the ancient church. And you'll find that interesting reading, I think, and you'll have some choice there as to which parts of that book you'll read. And then finally, either Augustine's Confessions, a good many of you may already have read that, or John Chrysostom on the priesthood. And I'll mention just now that the edition of Augustine's Confessions on your sheet listed under texts has gone out of print. It's hard to keep books in print these days. That's partly the IRS taxing inventory of publishers, but they go out of print very fast. So I've asked the bookstore to order the translation by Rex Warner, but there are several different editions of Augustine's Confessions. You may already own one. Use whatever one you can get a hold of. But the Rex Warner one is an inexpensive paperback version that is a good translation. The bookstore should have that soon, certainly by the time we get to that part of the course. And for those who may not want to read Augustine again, you can read John Chrysostom, who's a contemporary with Augustine, roughly, and you'll give you the Eastern Church perspective rather than the Western Church a little bit. So that's the third track of material, historical narrative texts, the history of doctrine, the primary materials, and then my lectures. And you go over to the third page, you'll see the lecture topics that I plan to cover. Generally one per week, and again, this will try to have it coincide with the place where we are in the reading roughly, but not necessarily exactly. And so you'll have these four different avenues for material coming at you to be absorbed. And one way to keep them together is to produce a timeline or chronological chart. Let me just comment on one more thing as an introductory comment, and when we come back from the break, we'll get into the first lecture topic. Just to give you a sense of what historians do, as Well, there was a famous historian back in the 1930s, Carl Becker, who wrote a book called Every Man His Own Historian. And it's true that whether you're a professional historian or not, the contemporary generation is very ahistorical. A lot of high school students have very little knowledge of even American history these days. And history has not been emphasized very much. But when you think about it, we all exist with some kind of history. Your own family roots, your own personal history from your childhood till now shapes your identity. And what we're trying to do as a body of Christians is to see what is our identity as a people of the Lord Jesus Christ. What has that history been?